It is my absolute pleasure to introduce the author of The Night Circus and the Starless Sea, Massachusetts native, owner of the world's cutest kitten, collector of blood milk jewelry, video game enthusiast, mixer of delicious cocktails, drinker of tea, and all-around fantastic human, the one and only, Erin Morgenstern.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. I'm so excited that you're here. Okay, so let's start out by talking about The Night Circus because, you know, I had a night circus wedding.
You did?
I have a night circus tattoo.
I can see it.
Just poking out there.
It's beautiful, by the way.
Thank you. It's not done. We're getting
there. What else are you doing to it?
Way more color.
Okay.
We're adding, Marco needed to heal a lot.
Oh, poor baby.
Poor Marco. He was in a sensitive spot.
Oh.
So I'm curious, because obviously I'm not the only person to have a night circus wedding and night circus tattoos, and we know of someone with a Starless Sea tattoo.
Yes, already.
What is that like for you?
It's so weird and so delightful.
Yeah.
Someone asked me in an interview not that long ago, like, how do you measure success? Is it like book sales? Is it Times List? Is it like, I looked at them and said, people get tattoos. Like, people want something that I created, like, embedded in ink on their skin, and it's not going to go away. It's like, that's the level of devotion to a work of art is beyond anything I could possibly imagine.
Oh, that must be wild. I know that there's a Facebook group for reviewers.
There is?
There is.
I avoid Facebook.
I don't blame you, but they are very sweet. They're a very nice group of humans. They're from all over the world, and most of them have a reviewer
tattoo.
That's
so cool.
I've seen some in the wild, which has been really cool, because I'm like,
do you like? Can you resist or do you kind of just like jump on them?
It depends on the context, but usually there's a little bit of pouncing of, I know what your tattoo means. Okay, so did you always want to be an author?
No.
No, because you were mixed media.
I was
artist,
a theater
right?
girl. I was at like visual art and theater were my things. Like, especially when I was little, I was better in art class than I was in math class, like constantly. Okay. And I didn't really know what I wanted. That didn't have that clear, this is what I want to be when I grow up. Like, I went through a phase where I wanted to be a Disney Imagineer just because it sounded like it, like, covered so many bases, you know?
Yes.
Like, because, like, you just get to come up with, like, amazing magical things. So
yeah.
I kind of do still do stuff that's kind of like that.
Yeah.
But then, all through high school and college, I was a theater person, and I got my degree from Smith in theater. And I never had that one theater thing I like wanted to focus on. I did a little bit of everything. I directed, I acted, I studied lighting design.
Mm.
And I think to pursue theater professionally, you kind of have to have the one thing you're going to pursue. Like, and I didn't really have the one that spoke to me more than any of the others. So I kind of gave up doing theater.
Mm.
And I was also burnt out at that point, I think.
That's fair. Theater's exhausting.
It is.
It's fun, but it's exhausting.
And I think, like, I'm that sort of, like, natural introvert who's good at pretending to be an extrovert.
Yes.
Like, with extrovert tendencies.
Yes.
And I think I only really realized how much of an introvert I am when I read, like, not super recently, but more recently than college, that definition that introverts recharge alone and extroverts recharge with other people.
Yeah.
And that's totally me. I need my alone time. Like, I can go. And I knew I had friends who would, like, get twitchy if they, like, didn't have something to do, like, that day. And I'd be like, I could literally not leave my house for a week and I'd be fine.
Yeah.
Like, I can go that long without speaking to people. That's absolutely fine. That actually sounds like heaven.
That is A-okay with
just
me.
Like, I have food. I have my cat. I'm good.
I have a friend who just went on what she called a reading retreat, where she literally went to a cabin in, I think, Vancouver and just read all week.
Oh, that's like ideal.
I was like, how do I do that? Take me with you.
Say, someone should have like a like introvert vacation site where you like give them like these are where the cabins are and like this is where no one will talk to you.
Oh, that sounds like a dream come true.
Like a very specialized like.
Oh, I want that. Just silence and books.
Yes.
And that's all you need.
I like going, I go to Stowe in Vermont because my husband goes snowboarding and I stay in the lodge and go to the spa and read by the fire and it's like my ideal vacation because I want an actual relaxing vacation and not a like, I'm going to go sightsee in someplace I haven't been like travel vacation. That's not.
Yeah.
Those are different.
As opposed to me who just went to Disney and ran a 5K, 10K half marathon and marathon.
Because there wasn't enough to do in Disney World
wasn't
already.
Enough. In Disney. And then we did full days in the parks, too.
Oh, of course. Well, you kind of have to. It'd be sad if you just went and did the marathon things and then went home without, like...
Right? That's what I said.
Going on some rides.
Yeah. So, yeah, very relaxing vacation that was.
Vacation needs to be in, like, quotes.
Vacation. So you didn't want to be an author. So what is your writing process like?
it's not very organized. I started writing, like, seriously writing, because I would do that thing where I would write, like, a page. Because I studied playwriting a little bit in college. I never finished any plays. I wrote, like, scenes. And I'd write, like, a page or two, and then I wouldn't like it, and I'd stop writing, which is not the way to be a writer. You need to write more pages and hate more of them. Eventually, you will get to something that you hate a little less. Mm-hmm. And the thing that kind of got me over that hurdle was National Novel Writing Month, which I got on board really early. Like, I'm not sure what exactly the first year I did it was, but it was either, like, 2004 or 2005. Oh, wow. And I think it only started in, like, 01 or 02.
Yeah.
Like, and it was not as well known as it is now. And I knew a few people who were doing it, and so I thought, oh, I could try that. Like, it's an online-based challenge to write 50,000 words in 30 days, which really does make you focus on just the quantity rather than the quality. So I would write pages, and I would still hate them, but I would have to write more pages, and when I just focused on the word count and not on, I never reread anything. I just kind of, like keep your eye on the prize and, like that 50K mark. And it was kind of a great mental trick for me because it got me over that hurdle of, like, being overly critical and just kind of letting me practice. Mm-hmm. But I also, I think because of that, I'm a binge writer because I would, like, literally write in November and not write hardly at all the rest of the year.
Yep.
Like, I'd maybe, like, go back and toy with something, but I'd never do anything in that sort of volume. Mm-hmm. And I did that for, like, I don't even know what that first one was about. It was a lot of nonsense. And then and I don't remember what the second one is, but I remember the third year I did it, I think this was the third year, I was writing this, like, Edward Gorey-inspired thing where men in fur coats are being mysterious and doing very little else. It was so boring. Because nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And the NaNoWriMo rule of thumb is usually when in doubt, just add ninjas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just for, you know, something exciting to happen, and I didn't want to have ninjas. But in that vein, I said, I need something exciting to happen. Maybe I'll send these people to a circus.
Amazing.
And the circus that popped up in my head in that moment was immediately way more interesting than anything, and way more interesting than these fur coat guys. And it was just in my head as a space. It was already, like, a lot of little tents and kind of clusters and, like, round, like, circular paths. It had a bonfire in the middle. I didn't know why. Just thought it would look cool. And then because the circus was so much more interesting, the next 2 years that I did National Novel Writing Month, I just wrote stuff about the circus.
Mm.
And it was just all these little bits and pieces about the circus. And eventually I had, like, over 100,000 words about circus things. And that is what became the rough draft of The Night Circus. A lot of people will say The Night Circus was, like, quote-unquote written during National Novel Writing Month, which is so not true. It was, like, messily drafted over 2 years worth of Dano. And when people ask, like, well, how different is the finished book, my example is usually nowhere in that 2 years worth of National Novel Writing Month drafting does Celia appear. She's not in it.
Wow.
Like, she's okay. The protagonist. She's not in it. It's just like,
yeah.
It's like every second person tent is like 10 to 20 pages long.
Wow.
It's like, it's all these little, like, because it's all in vignettes, I would just write, like, a random vignette, not knowing if I'd use it or not. And so, but it actually made it easier, I think, for me to revise because I could have these, like, jigsaw puzzle pieces that I could pull out the ones that were working and I'd discard the ones that weren't and just write new stuff to layer over the old stuff. Like, the prologue is probably from that original draft.
Wow.
And, like, but very little else that remains.
That's so funny. So do you have a favorite tent then, since you spent so much time in the circus?
I do have a favorite tent. My favorite tent's probably the Ice Garden, mostly because it's the one I would most like to be in. Like, talk about the introvert thing. Like, I just want the quiet walk around, like, observe, and I don't want anyone else to be there. Or if there are other people there, they can be, like, on the other side of the tent. Like,
also quiet.
Yes. It's like, but I think you would be quiet. I think it seems like
it's would like,
lend itself to that. Yeah, it's like, you know, like the first time that you get the really heavy snow, everything seems very, very quiet. It has like that tone.
Yeah.
But like just to be able to see that sort of like, I can write it's a flower made of ice, but then to have it have individual petals and be able to look at it, that's something else.
That's really cool. Yeah, the garden is definitely one of my favorites. I also really
do you have a very favorite?
I love the wishing well. I just love that, like, when you, like, sit down and you're, like, ugh, everything's okay now. Yes. That, like, release of, just I felt it when I read it.
Yeah, I like that we're talking about, like, the quieter times. Like, going in from, like, our introvert discussion. We're like, but I wanted that. I didn't want it to feel like a place that you were being, like, bombarded by entertainment constantly. I wanted it to feel exploratory, and I wanted you to be able to have those quiet moments. Like, and I think this sort of nocturnalness lends itself to that, too, where it's, like, it's a quiet nighttime place.
Yeah. It's more of an exploration than
I know sometimes people are just like, you must love the circus. I'm just like, nah, not really. Not in a traditional, like, elephants and clowns sort of way. Like, I think my circus is more like performance art dressed up in the trappings of a circus.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I sometimes call it, like, because of the color scheme, it's like a circus in evening wear.
Yes. I love that.
It's a formally dressed circus. It's like, with its tuxedo and its black and white stripes.
I love it.
Wait. Ryan, do you like the Night Circus?
It's, you know, it's up there.
You're wearing a Night Circus t-shirt right now, by the way.
Like, I am.
There's some visuals that are getting lost in the podcast format.
It's true. I have my Night Circus bag and my scarf over there. And
it's also very fun to have merch, to be the sort of...
Oh, that's got to be so cool. That has merch.
Yeah, the out-of-print collection in particular, like, I was so excited when they asked me if I wanted to do it. Yeah. Because it just looks very cool. And I like that they didn't do the full cover. They just did the tent art, and then they put the circus arrives with a warning under it. It doesn't even have the title.
Yeah.
It's subtle. I like it.
It is. I like it a lot. I tried to explain to my daughter what was on my shirt. She was very confused.
That's okay.
I was like, it's a circus. She's been watching a lot of Dumbo. So I was like, no, like, Dumbo goes to a circus. And she just kind of, like, looked at me. And I was like,
are you sure?
Fair. I was like, that's fair.
I think you might be making stuff up, mommy.
Okay. So, we got to talk about your new book, The Starless Sea, which was my favorite book of 2019.
Yay, thank you.
And I threw it at every person who walked into the store.
You like book enablers.
And I think, actually, it came up in every single episode of last year's podcast.
Okay, that's
funny. I think it came up every episode, if not...
Did you just find a way to work it?
Pretty much. Yeah, because it was either I'm reading it, or I've read it, or... I don't know, I'm introducing you and me, but, you know, it just always came up a lot. So our listeners have heard me gush about it a lot, but it just, you know, it's such a love story to stories, which as a bookseller I have to thank you for, because, like, it just, I read it and I was like, yes, this is what books are. Like, it was so, so warm and golden honey and sparkly and perfect. But on that thread, talking about the Starless Sea being, you know, warm golden honey and the Night Circus being, you know, formal wear and black and white and red, like, your books have such clear aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that. Like, where does that come from? How do you visualize that?
I'm a very visual person. Like, I see things in my head. When I was talking earlier about, like, having that circus with all the tents and the bonfire, like, in my head, like, I have a picture in that space in my head immediately. And I had the same thing with Starless Sea. I had this space that was sort of an underground library-esque space. I don't like to call it a library, and it took me a while to figure out why I didn't like to call it a library. It's because it doesn't have librarians.
Mm.
And I feel like if you're a magical space full of books and you don't have librarians, you're just a magical space full of books. Like, you're not really library. No one's going to help you find what you're looking for here. Like, you're on your own.
That is true.
But I had this, like, it looked like a subway and a museum, like, had a baby, like, and it's all filled with books, and, like, you have these tunnels that go off and, like, curve, and all you can see are sort of books in every direction, and then maybe a cat walks by. But I had this space, and I knew after having done the Night Circus and seeing how people responded to the visuals of it, which I just sort of did, like, naturally, because I wanted it to have a color scheme, and I liked that, like, black and white with pops of red, just as a visual. I wanted this book to also have a strong visual language, and it sort of did end up having a color scheme at the end of the day, because everything's subterranean and dipped in gold and honey. Yeah. But instead of focusing on that, I focused on giving it symbols and having it have, like, a distinct set of repeating, like, visual iconography that I could lean on for, like, something has a bee on it, and something has a key on it, and something has a sword on it. And I didn't want to explain too much about what that meant, but I wanted them to be there, and, like, you kept encountering them. because I think in pictures and I think in like sort of moments more than I think in words. Like I'll sometimes have dialogue that will pop up, probably goes back to the playwriting. Yep. But I don't think so much in the words. I think more in terms of, I have this picture in my head. What are the best words to use to conjure a similar picture in the reader's head? And it goes back to something I think in Stephen King's On Writing, he talks about writing as telepathy, and that's like the writing process. Like, I'm taking something that's in my head and putting down words to transmit this, like, a similar, because it's never going to be exactly the same. That's one of the other things I love about it. It's a similar visual in the reader's head, and I like that collaborativeness of it as well. But I think because I'm so visual, I often have trouble finding the words for it. I use thesaurus.com a lot because sometimes I'm just like, it's a word that's like this word, but it's not that word. And I can't remember what the word I'm thinking of is. And then I'll like fall down the rabbit hole clicking like synonyms page after page until I find the words that sound. And then I get a little hung up on the rhythm of the sentences also. Mm-hmm. My writing process is not the most efficient. I don't know if you can tell. But I wanted to have it, I think it adds to the immersiveness. Because I do tend to, I start with spaces, and I want it to feel like you're in this space when you're reading. And I think having a strong visual helps with that. Having, like, describing different senses. Like, I like to describe how things smell a lot. I always like to describe the lighting. Probably, again, going back to the lighting design thing. But lighting affects the mood of a room drastically. Like, you can have the same exact room and change absolutely nothing. But if it's lit with fluorescent overhead lights or it's lit with candlelight, those are two very different spaces and very different moods. And I think you often don't get a lot of description on either lighting or scent when you're reading fiction. And so I like to try to do both.
Absolutely. So effectively, because it is very visual. It's, your books are some of the more visual books I've ever read. Okay. Video games. Video games play a huge role in the Starless Sea, and I know that you're a big video game fan. I am someone who, I did not grow up playing video games, and I never really had a video game system. I have the Goose Game, the Untitled Goose Game on my computer. But that's sort of the extent of my knowledge. So, two-part question. What drew you to video games, and what made that transition into your books? Like, okay. Why do you think video games work so well in the Starless Sea?
I had that weird video game kind of genesis where when I was younger, I had like classic Nintendo, old school, like Super Mario Brothers, Duck Hunt, original Legend of Zelda. And then I didn't have a gaming system because it was that point where when the next gen started coming out with like the Super Nintendo, my parents were like, you already have one. Like, so I didn't get those. And then I kind of fell off the video game wagon. I played Myst on my computer in high school.
I did have Myst. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was sort of the one gaming thing I did. And Myst is still like one of those formative video game things for me. And I love that. That also probably very much feeds into my like exploratory like ideas where I get like really hung up on like how you navigate a space. I'm thinking about it now. It's probably a lot of it is Myst's fault. Just that idea of like you can go this way and go down this path and you find this thing and like, or you could go another way. Like the way you navigate space in my imaginary spaces is very Myst-like. But then I didn't play anything for the longest time, and then it wasn't until I was like in my 20s, and I kind of would do that thing where you'd like watch other people play video games and not really play anything myself, because video games suddenly looked way fancier than I was used to, and I was just like, oh, this looks like actually difficult. But then I started playing more when I met my husband, and like he would actually make me try things. I think a lot of people who just enjoy being observed and don't want to encourage other people to try things, but like Adam would like actually make me play things, and it didn't take me long to realize, oh, you're just pressing like two buttons. This is not that complicated. It looks fancy and complicated on the screen because you're executing some like sort of fancy move, but it's just like you just press the A button like twice. That's fine. I can probably handle this. And I think Skyrim was probably the one that I got into, which is, again, is very much a big open world RPG. Like, kind of you can go do what you want, and if you don't want to deal with fighting these things right now, you can go off and do something else, which is very much my style. Just being able to walk in more than two directions in a video game was like mind-blowing.
Yeah.
When seriously. You're used to the side-scrolling like 8-bit things. And then I kind of got more into it when I was working or trying to work on this book, because I find it a little hard to read while I'm trying to write. Mm-hmm. Which is really frustrating because I am a big reader and I like to read. But, like, when you're just looking at words all day, like, I wanted to do anything that wasn't look at words. But I still wanted to stay engaged with something. And I didn't want to just, like, sit and watch television or sit and watch movies. And so I started playing more video games because I thought it was a great way to consume story while still feeling like I was actively doing something. And, like, I could think about book things like in the back of my head while I'm like traversing to get from like quest A to quest B. And while I was doing that, I was playing a game called Dragon Age Inquisition, which is one of my very favorite games. But it's very much a narrative-driven role-playing game where the choices you make as a character, as the player character, like, affect how the story goes. Like, if you make one choice, like, you literally can't play this other chunk of the game. Like, and, like, it very much defines the arc of the story by the choices that you make. You have all, like, your non-player characters who have, like, approval meters. Like, so they will not be friends with you if they don't like what you're doing.
Whoa!
Like, it's the detail level from a narrative, like, standpoint is fascinating to me. Like, all the butterfly effects you can get from making different choices. So I was thinking about this in narrative structure while I was already working on a book that was about stories and story structure and fairy tales and myth retellings. And I had that sort of light bulb moment where I felt like a ding-dong because I already had Zachary, who's the protagonist of The Starless Sea, in my head. I knew he was a grad student. I knew he was studying something that was probably story related. And I knew I didn't want to make him an English major because I thought it was a little too on the nose. So I had that moment while playing Dragon Age thinking, oh, you can probably get advanced degrees in game study now.
Yes.
And you, of course you can.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, what a perfect thing for him to be studying because I wanted it to feel kind of old and new at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that perfect new layer to put on top of this book because I thought I was writing a book about books when I started because I love books about books. Mm-hmm. And then it slowly started to morph into like stories that weren't just books and fairy tales and myths and things. And then I started thinking about, well, what's the difference between a book and a story? And it started coming back to stories are malleable.
Mm-hmm.
And stories can be changed, and like the format and that idea, like retellings are different versions of like video games, and it all kind of layered so nicely. It really was one of those things that, like, you talk about like the jigsaw puzzle pieces fitting, it fits so well. Yeah. It just seems silly that I hadn't had it there the whole time.
Zachary was like, I play video games!
Yes, yes, ding dong. Like, I knew he wasn't an English major, but I'm just, like, stuck on, like, I should have just, like, pulled out, like, I actually got the phrase, I called it new media for a very long time in a draft, and then I had, my agency got contacted by someone who wanted to use the Night Circus as part of a school project where they were an emerging media student, and I was just like, I am stealing that phrase because that's exactly what it is. And I like now being able to like babble about video games when I'm promoting the book because I think there's a lot of people who have this impression that like all video games are Halo and like all video games are like guys in suits shooting things, and I really do think there's so much innovation, especially innovation on a storytelling level, going on in games right now. Like, I've had some of the best like storytelling moments that I've experienced in the last like 5 years while playing video games. And I do think it's that sort of thing where just like there's probably like a book in a various genres for every reader. I think there's probably a game for every player.
I think you're right. That is awesome. So on this podcast, we talk about audiobooks all the time because we partner with Libre FM, who offers audiobooks for indie bookstores. And you have been so lucky.
I have.
You have some of the best audiobook narrators in the business.
I'm a lucky, lucky girl.
So The Night Circus is read by Jim Dale.
Yes.
Who famously did the Harry Potter books.
I got to see some of that recording.
Ugh.
I got to go one day when they were recording, and the thing that I found fascinating was that he essentially does it in one take.
Stop.
He reads like 3 pages. Then if they didn't pick something up or something was a little garbled or too fast, they'll go back and do like the single line. Okay. And that's it.
Wow.
And then they go on to the next 3 pages and the next 3 pages. And at one point while I was there, I was outside the booth and he can see me through the glass and I'm watching him read stuff that I wrote. And this is before the book came out, so this is even weirder.
Yeah.
And he tripped over something and he turned and looked at me through the glass and said, "Why did you name her Tsukiko? It's hard to say." And I was like, "I'm sorry, Jim Dale, I did not anticipate you needing to say her name so many times." Because you don't think about these things when you're writing.
No.
Like, someone's going to have to say this. I try not to think about it for Starless Sea too much Like, yeah. I tried to forget that it was going to be a book and just focus on, like, telling the story. Because, I think if you, like, start thinking, oh, someone has to say this, like, on an audiobook, you get a little distracted.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that would consume my every waking thought. That's incredible. And then The Starless Sea is read by Dominic Hoffman, who recently read Wanderers.
I was going to say, when I was listening to samples, because they sent me, like, a list of possible narrators, because we talked about, at one point, they said, do you think we could do, like, one male narrator? And I said, if you find one male narrator who can pull off Cat, more power to you. I think it probably needs to be multiple voices, because it is multiple books within the book. So we ended up doing, like, one main narrator, which is Dominic, and then a different narrator for each other part. But it was fun because I got to go listen to samples, and Wanderers was one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
But, like, Wanderers, I had so many moments of, my friend Chuck wrote this.
That must be so cool.
It is. It's very strange to, like, know some of the people who live on my bookshelf now.
Yeah. That's, yeah, Wanderers was incredible. And again, I've talked about that on the podcast a ton. Wow, what a book.
It's kind of amazing.
Ugh. That is really cool. Do you ever listen to audiobooks?
Not a whole lot, but I did just listen. I listened to The Testaments on audio, which was actually a really great audiobook. Like, just as the book, because it is all the diaries, so you felt like the characters were talking to you.
Yeah,
especially the Anne Dowd Aunt Lydia sections, which were amazing. Oh, sidebar. In December, I got to do Margaret Atwood's 80th birthday celebration at the New York Public Library, where I read sections of Handmaid's Tale in between performances by the Boston Lyric Opera, doing those same bits of their Handmaid's Tale opera.
What?
And then Anne Dowd was there and read from Testaments, and I got to sit next to her, and she was so lovely. It was like...
Your life is so cool.
It's very weird. It's very weird.
That's amazing.
It was an extraordinary evening. And Claire Danes was supposed to be there to read some of Margaret Atwood's poems, but she had the flu.
Oh.
So they asked Margaret to do it, and she did.
Oh, I just got full blown chills.
It was. I know they recorded it. So if you check the, like, New York Public Library, like, archives, you might be able to watch it.
Noted. That's amazing.
But that audio is great.
Yeah. I also did the audiobook of that one. It was fantastic. It does feel... I really like audiobooks. I mean, I have a long commute to and from work, so I listen to audiobooks a lot in the car. But I do love ones where it just feels like they're just telling you a story.
Yes.
You're just hanging out with the main character, and they're just telling you a story. It's just so...
I think there's something nice about, like, that, like, listening to a story. Especially, like Jim Dale for The Night Circus. He has such a storyteller voice. Like, he really has that thing of, like, you feel like he's telling you a story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a like, a tone and a cadence that, like, certain, like, voices have it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it kind of transports you, like, before, like, you even get into it, just the tone of the voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. what are you reading right now?
I am reading my tour reading because I wanted to have books that I knew I'd be able to get absorbed into and forget that I was on so many airplanes, but that also fit in my luggage. So I've been working my way through Robin Hobb's Farseer trilogy, which I've never read. And the reason I picked it up was because it's actually the last year was the 25th anniversary of Assassin's Apprentice, which is the first one.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, these seem like they're up my alley. Like, I like a good meaty fantasy, and I haven't read one in a while, and I'm, like, literally obsessed with them. I'm, like, just at the beginning of the third one. So
that's awesome.
I'm hopefully going to, like, I'm at my, like, tail end of tour, so I'm not going to be able to finish it on tour, which I thought. I thought I'd be able, like, be done with them by, like, week three. Of, like, but no, I was just, like, I was asleep on airplanes.
I was just
I can't. But they weren't, like, they're that sort of thing where you just get so lost in this world, and it's so richly drawn, and it really does feel like that very classic fantasy, but her magic system is fascinating, and the history and the details of the world are really fascinating, and I really like that sort of book that really feels like you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're in someplace else. You like, it's funny because when I write, I like that sort of fantasy that feels like it's, like, brushing up against the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when I read, I want to be somewhere way far away.
Totally. Yeah. No, I totally get that. You just want to, like, fully escape.
Yes. I want to be somewhere else entirely.
It's like, sometimes you want to, like, imagine that this could happen in your real world, and then sometimes
Of, like, I think Chuck Wendig predicted one too many things in Wanderers and needs to stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wanderers is getting way too, like, the news lately is just like, this is a plot point from Wanderers, and this is very creepy.
Yep, he tweeted an article this morning, and I was like, no.
Yeah, like, the AI predicted the coronavirus thing. It's just like, yeah, that's a little too on the nose, Chuck.
Yep.
Chuck knows something that we don't know.
Calm down, Wendig. I have a feeling I know what you'll be talking about here, but what book other than your own would you like to recommend to our listeners?
Ooh, it's getting so close. I felt like such a tease for so long, being like, it's not out until February, but now it's January, so February is very close. There is a book coming out, I believe, February 11th, 2020, called The Unwilling by Kelly Braffett, and it is one of my I don't really have books instantly jump onto the all-time favorites list that often. And I realize the more I read, like, the more I realize I'm actually kind of picky. But I love this book so much. It is, again, one of those big, meaty fantasy that you just feel like you're in it. And the wonderful thing about it is it's I've read her previous books, and she writes these normally very realistic, very, like, kind of, like, dark, gritty, realistic kind of books that are very real world, very modern. And then it came out that she was writing a fantasy, and I thought, wait, what? Like, it was that I love Kelly Raffett, and I love fantasy, and could this be a chocolate peanut butter situation where it's, like, these are two things that, like, are good separately, or they're going to taste great together. And it is beyond anything I could have hoped for. It is so, so good. It's, like, even, like, 100 pages in, I felt like I was on book three of a series. Like, it felt like a world that I knew. I felt like I understood the characters. It's very character-driven.
Yeah.
It was what I wanted after I was so mad at Game of Thrones.
Yes.
It's kind of a very good, like, antidote.
Yeah, it's like a soothing balm for your soul.
It's just like, oh, this is so much better. But how's those fantasy, like, elements that you like? Yeah. And we were talking about it earlier because you read it. It's like, and it's fun for me because I actually read it super early. They sent me, like, bound manuscript, and, like, hardly anyone had it. And so it's kind of fun sometimes. Like, I get to read things in a bubble and form my own opinion without any sort of outside noise. And I loved that book to little pieces when I read it. And then I sort of got like, oh, I hope other people like it too. Like, I really, really want them to because I love it so much. And it's been my book to force upon people. I've talked about it pretty much like every book tour stop where they're just like, is there a book you would recommend? And it's like, may I tell you? I'm willing. I can't leave out it. But I do think it's also a good one for, like, if you like my books.
Yeah.
It's probably a good one. Or if you like that high fantasy kind of strong character, like political intrigue-y kind of stuff. She does so many interesting things.
She does.
With that level of it.
But in a very, I would say, accessible way.
Yes.
Like, it's not a daunting.
Yeah, and you're getting it, you get it from very focused points within the world. Like, you know there are other things going on, like, elsewhere in the world, but you're very focused in one area, like, with certain characters, and you're more concerned with those character dynamics and how the greater, like, political world is impacting them rather than, like, all the wars that are being fought over in distant places.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, guys, just order it. It's really
please.
Good. We have pre-order cards.
I have pre-ordered, like, I'm not kidding, like, three different copies. Because I pre-ordered it from, like, one bookstore, and then, like, you can pre-order, I think, signed copies from Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, and then, like, pre-ordered it somewhere else. Like, I need to help our numbers. Absolutely. I should just, like, buy piles of them and, like, hand them out on street corners. Like, read this book, please.
Just trust me. I love that. Okay. Switching gears a little bit. This is a little bit of a touchy subject, I think, for both of us. Your books sometimes get categorized as young adult.
I knew from the look on your face what the question was going to be.
Is that frustrating for you?
It's frustrating for me as, like, a writer who doesn't really like that idea of classifying stories for age ranges.
Yeah.
Like, I'm, like, personally, like, I have a weird relationship with it because, why it wasn't really a category when I was younger. Like, I went straight from reading, like, Babysitter's Club to Stephen King, which, like, says a lot about me. But I don't really have that sense of, like, this is a book for teenagers. And when I'm writing, I don't have a sense of this is a book for teenagers. But then whenever I have to clarify that they're not classified by publishing as young adult books, people always get mad at me because they interpret that as I'm saying they're not books for teenagers. And it's like, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying they're not books that are like solely for teenagers or predominantly like aimed at teenagers, because then you get into like those weird levels of like plenty of adults read YA, which mm-hmm. is also cool, like read what you love, like, and like it's so frustrating for me because I'm not thinking about who am I writing this for. I know like some writers are thinking this is what my audience is, this is that, and I think there are people who are writing for teenagers who are doing like writing very specific teenage things and doing marvelous job at it, but that's not what I'm doing.
No.
And part of me figuring out the sort of thing I wanted to write was when I was kind of toying with different ideas, and I thought maybe I should write YA because I was like it was the early 2000s. It was a thing everyone
was
doing.
It was blowing up.
But I wasn't sure I wanted to, and I read a book called The Book of Lost Things by John Connolly. Mm-hmm. And the little blurb on the back that was like about the book and about the author had that it had won the American Library Association Alex Award, which is given to books written for adults with appeal for teen readers. Hmm. And I thought, that's what I want to write.
Nice.
And in 2011, The Night Circus got the Alex Award,
yes!
Which nailed it. So it was really like, that was sort of like, oh, I like, that's what I wanted to do. But it is, there's that undertone also, because I know it happens to other like women authors who write fantasy, mm-hmm. just get tossed mm-hmm. into YA. And I do think that my books are like appropriate for teen readers, but some of them get thrown in there that are not appropriate for younger readers. And it's frustrating, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. Like, even I thought I could see The Night Circus, and people have given me various reasons that they think The Night Circus gets classified as YA. And they did do an edition in the UK as part of like the vintage children's line, but it was their like for older readers. They literally did Handmaid's Tale in the same series.
Yeah.
But then people will be like, but it's a children's book because it has this one edition. It's just like, but it's not. And then people will say because of the Bailey plot, which is, it's
sure.
like, you can't really say that's like any book with a teenage character in it is
no.
a YA book. And it's interesting in the same way that I sometimes get classified as women's fiction, which, yeah, that's the noise to make for that, is also a thing, because I still haven't gotten anyone to give me, like, I can sort of see where you're going to try to argue YA. Like, I'll give you a little bit of leeway on that, but I don't really think, like, Starless Sea gets classified as women's fiction. I'm just like, there is no reason other than the fact that a woman wrote it.
Yeah.
Not really understanding the reasoning behind that. I think I'm going to try to focus on writing what I want to write, and, like, people should read what they want to read.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, you and I are on the same page there.
Okay.
We're about to wrap up, but before we do, what is either a question that you never get asked that you'd love to answer, or just something you would love your readers to know?
I feel like I can't pass up the opportunity to do follow my cat on Instagram, mm-hmm. because my whole MO of this entire book tour and all the, like, I've tried to get it into as many interviews as I can. It's my whole goal in life now to just have like an Instagram famous cat. Mm-hmm. My cat is the cutest cat in the world. Do you know about cute aggression? Where
yes.
something's so cute it kind of makes you mad?
Yep.
Yeah, she does that mm-hmm. a lot. Her name is Vesper. You can follow her on Instagram at Lady Vesper the Cat. I'm going to be better about posting more pictures, because I've been telling people the whole time, I've been like on the road being like, follow my cat on Instagram, and then I'm not home to take more pictures of my cat and post them. I need to do like throwback photos.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that's always a good plug for my cat. And like, I think, and in Instagram in general, I'm also at Erin Morgenstern, tie back to visuals. I like Instagram as a social media because I think it's fun to get a visual mm-hmm. context for like to follow an author
yes.
and follow their visuals. Like
yes.
I think about that when I'm posting things. I'm like, yeah. I do this thing that I don't always intend to do it, but my Instagram kind of follows subtle color schemes.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed.
Like, I'll segue it. Sometimes it's easy because it's like, it's autumn, so it'll have like a lot of autumnal colors, because like every other photo is a like autumnal foliage thing. But then I've done the like last, if you look at my Instagram right now, I think like two rows back, it's like there's a couple different pops of like a ballet pink, and I did that on purpose. And I like to have it look very like, I I curate it in a...
I love that.
Like, not an overly curated, because some people will do, like, specific things, like, yeah, tile, like, and I can't think of that hard, but I will do the, like, oh, I did a pink, so I should do another pink, or, oh, something was very blue, so I should do another blue, and have it, like, segue.
Yeah.
And then Vespers is just, like, kitten picture, kitten picture, kitten picture.
Which is exactly what it should be.
Exactly.
Vespers is perfect. amazing. Well... thank you so much for being on the
podcast. Thank you. This was so fun.
I'm so glad you were able to come. The Starless Sea is available now. Everyone, go buy it for yourselves. Go buy it for every person in your life. The Night Circus as well. Just trust me. Trust Karen. I'm an expert, so just do it. Just buy it.
Listen to Ryan.